And that's it. Labor news you can use. You can find our international features and daily newscasts at radiolabor.net. Follow us on Twitter at Radio Labor. I'm Mark Belanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about solidarity.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minneapolis, lawyers for the defense and prosecution made opening arguments Monday in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin, who faces murder and manslaughter charges for killing George Floyd last May. Floyd was a 46-year-old black father who was originally from Houston, Texas. His death sparked international protests calling for racial justice. As the trial kicked off Monday, civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton knelt outside the Hennepin County Courthouse with members of Floyd's family and supporters for 9 minutes, marking the amount of time Derek Chauvin was filmed kneeling on George Floyd's neck. This is Floyd family attorney Benjamin Crump.
We needed to pray for this family, but also we needed to pray for America, because this is a seminal moment, a landmark moment. Right. In American history.
After headlines, we'll go to Minneapolis for the latest on the trial of Derek Chauvin and the police killing of George Floyd. In Georgia, voting rights groups have filed a second lawsuit seeking to block a sweeping voter suppression law signed by the Republican governor, Brian Kemp, last week. The law grants broad power to state officials to take control of election management from local and county election boards, adds new voter ID requirements, and even makes it a crime to hand out food or water to voters waiting in line at polling places. Meanwhile, the children of prominent civil rights leaders have condemned Georgia's business leaders for their silence on Republican-led voter suppression efforts. In a joint letter, they write, quote, "The failure of corporate leaders across our state to live up to their racial equity commitments made in the last year disregards and disrespects our fathers' tireless work and jeopardizes the soul of Georgia and the promise of democracy," they said. The letter was signed by Bernice King, daughter of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., Al Vivian, the son of Reverend C.T. Vivian, and John Miles Lewis, son of the late Congressman John Lewis. The World Health Organization has wrapped up its investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, concluding in a new report it's very likely the novel coronavirus passed from a bat to an intermediate animal host before emerging in humans in late 2019, with China's wildlife trade the most likely pathway. The WHO also found it's possible, though less likely, that the virus passed directly from bats to humans and that it was extremely unlikely that the virus emerged from a laboratory. Globally, confirmed cases of COVID-19 have topped 127 million, with nearly 2.8 million deaths. In France, doctors warn that the ICUs in Paris and elsewhere could soon be overwhelmed as authorities rush to speed up the rollout of vaccines amidst an ongoing wave of cases. This is an intensive care doctor in the northern town of Cambrai.
We can describe the situation as catastrophic at the moment. We weren't really expecting a resurgence of this epidemic as fast and intense as this, because right now we're submerged in severe cases, people who are younger than the last time.
Here in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is warning of the potential for a rapid rise in new COVID-19 cases and deaths. On Monday, the U.S. recorded nearly 70,000 new coronavirus infections, a more than 10% rise in cases from a week ago. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says she's concerned about a fourth wave of disease across the U.S.
I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared.
President Biden urged governors and mayors across the United States to recommit to requiring mask wearing and social distancing. Biden also said 90% of U.S. adults will be eligible for a vaccine by mid-April. Here in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo has expanded vaccine access to everyone 30 years and older beginning today. The move came as a state judge ordered New York to immediately offer a COVID-19 vaccine to all incarcerated people because they're unable to socially distance at high risk of contracting the virus. The Centers for Disease Control has extended a federal moratorium on evictions to June 30th due to continuing community spread of the coronavirus. The moratorium had been set to expire Wednesday. Housing Secretary Marcia Fudge has suggested she wants to keep the federal ban on evictions in place even longer. A new report finds the wealthiest Americans are hiding 20% of their earnings from the IRS. The National Bureau of Economic Research report also found the wealthiest 1% of U.S. residents account for about one-third of all unpaid U.S. taxes. Last week, Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders unveiled legislation that would restore the U.S. corporate tax rate to 35%. Levy new taxes on the estates of extremely wealthy people and would prohibit companies from shifting profits offshore to avoid U.S. taxes. A warning to our audience, this story contains graphic descriptions of police violence. In Mexico, protests have erupted over the police killing of Victoria Salazar, a 36-year-old Salvadoran mother of two who'd been living in Mexico with a humanitarian visa. Four police officers from the coastal city of Tulum have been charged with femicide after an autopsy concluded Salazar's neck had been broken while she was being arrested. In videos published by Mexican media this weekend, one of the four officers is seen kneeling on Salazar's back. She's pinned against the pavement as she cries. Salazar lies on the pavement, face down, handcuffed and unconscious, while three other officers watch. Eventually, they pick up Salazar's motionless body and put her in the back of a police vehicle before driving away. This is Salazar's mother, Rosabel Arriaza, speaking from El Salvador.
I feel indignation. I feel so powerless and angry. Justice for my daughter.
In Egypt, salvage teams cleared a massive container ship from the Suez Canal Monday after it ran aground March 23rd and halted traffic through one of the world's busiest waterways for nearly a week. The ship is the size of the Empire State Building on its side. The Suez Canal Authority expects it'll take days to clear a backlog of hundreds of stranded ships. In California, over 60 unaccompanied migrant children being held at the San Diego Convention Center have tested positive for COVID-19. The convention center is currently holding over 700 children, according to local media. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting Border Patrol facilities across the Texas-Mexico border are so overcrowded, border agents recently started holding hundreds of asylum seekers under a bridge near McAllen, where they are forced to sleep on the dirt. Border agents have also been dropping off hundreds of asylum seekers at bus stations and even hotels. This comes as a record number of asylum seekers are arriving to the southern border, fleeing extreme poverty, violence, and climate change in their home countries. The Arkansas State Senate has passed a bill that would ban gender-affirming care to transgender minors, including hormones and puberty blockers. If Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson signs the bill, Arkansas will become the first U.S. state to ban gender-affirming care to trans youth. Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice at the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project, denounced the bill as, quote, the single most extreme anti-trans law to ever pass through a state legislature. Another warning to our audience, the next two stories contain graphic descriptions of sexual harassment and violence. Here in New York, a 10th woman has accused Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual misconduct. Sherry Ville says Cuomo made unwanted physical advances toward her while the two interacted in 2017. Ville met Cuomo while he toured her neighborhood in Rochester after a flood. Ville says Cuomo approached her at her home, took her hand, pulled her to him. Cuomo then leaned down over her and kissed both her cheeks. Ville described their interaction as, quote, overtly sexual and disrespectful of her husband and son, who were both present. Ville shared her experience during a virtual news conference yesterday.
I felt he was acting in a highly flirtatious and inappropriate manner, especially in front of my family and neighbors. He is almost 6 feet tall. I'm approximately 5 feet tall. He towered over me. There was nothing I could do.
In more news from New York, Ghislaine Maxwell, the British socialite who's accused of luring girls to be sexually abused by convicted predator and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, has been indicted on two more sex trafficking charges, including trafficking a minor. The indictment says Maxwell met the girl, who was about 14 at the time, at Epstein's Florida home around 2001, and that the girl had been, quote, recruited to provide Epstein with sexualized massages. The indictment also extends the time frame Maxwell collaborated with Epstein by several years, starting in 1994 to 2004. And in South Dakota, two indigenous activists face criminal charges over their roles in opposing construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, which President Biden halted on his first day in office. The pair are among a small number of water and land defenders who vowed to maintain an encampment on the Cheyenne River Indian Reservation near the pipeline route until all pipeline infrastructure is removed. Jocelyn Charger faces up to a year in prison for an act of nonviolent civil disobedience, and Oscar Hayoke faces up to 22 years in prison for what his supporters say are trumped-up charges, including aggravated assault on law enforcement. This is Oscar Hayoke's aunt speaking from the courthouse last week.
The ability to bring charges against citizens has always been abused and overused when it comes to indigenous response to the protection of our relatives and their habitats and their drinking source, which includes all four-legged, all two-legged, all platinum, all watersheds, and all indigenous unceded territories.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized-owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community. Montreal singer-songwriter Adelaya is on the rise. Listen to her critically acclaimed debut album, What We Say in Private, and follow-up EP, Woman Here, now available on all platforms. Follow her to be the first to hear when new music drops. Learn more at adaleamusic.com. Funded by Factor.
It was almost love, almost something worth singing about.
Sandra Boza, a voice of power and passion. Songs that touch your heart and fuel your soul. Winner of the Toronto Blues Society Talent Search, Sandra Boza is an R&B, soul, and Americana singer-songwriter. Her latest release, Falling Away From Me, is filled with deep grooves that reveal her sultry and soulful vocals. Catch a live online concert with high-definition sound and videography coming April 10th. Tickets and info available now at sandraboza.com. sandraboza.com.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday will have a light rain and a high of 12 degrees Celsius. Thursday, April 1st, will have snow and a high of 1 degree Celsius. Friday, there will be a mix of sun and clouds and a high of minus 2 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be mainly sunny with a high of minus 2 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be cloudy with sunny breaks and a high of 9 degrees Celsius. Monday, there will be a mix of sun and clouds and a high of 10 degrees Celsius. Tuesday, there will be the chance of a shower and a high of 12 degrees Celsius. Well, that wraps up the show for you today. Keep listening to CKUT.
Thank you. alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
In December, we asked you, what are the organizations that inspire you? Who are the activists leading progressive change? And who are the rabble-rousers to watch in 2021? And you responded. Over the next while, we'll be running both print and audio features on rabble.ca about the people and organizations you nominated. Hi, and welcome to our newest series of Rabble podcasts, focusing on rabble-rousers to watch. Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Rabble Rousers to Watch podcast. In 2020, amidst the pandemic, the district government of Muskoka has declared a climate emergency. They've endorsed a plan which will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2030 and take them down to zero by 2050. This is a region which votes staunchly conservative every provincial and federal election. Muskoka is also cottage country, full of lakes, rivers, forests, and a premium destination for people who want to protect the outdoors. But environmental action doesn't happen by itself. Today we'll hear about an organization that's finding success in building awareness. The organization behind the curtain is Climate Action Muskoka. Today I hand the microphone over to my friend and colleague Maya Bular. Maya is the editor of the Lynn Williams Activist Toolkit here at Rabble. We're working together, along with our other Rabble colleagues, to bring you the stories and voices of the people nominated by you. Maya has also written an article about Climate Action Muskoka, and we thought you might want to hear from the guests in their own words and in their own voices. Maya talked to Sue McKenzie and Linda Mathers on February 5th. Sue McKenzie is a retired elementary teacher, a longtime activist, a mother, and co-founder of Climate Action Muskoka. Sue, her husband Len Ring, and children have had the privilege of extensive world travel, but have now committed not to travel by air again to cut their carbon footprint. Linda Mathers is also a retired educator. She's been a longtime volunteer and climate advocate at both the community and political level, as well as a key organizer with Climate Action Muskoka. Our interview starts with Sue, talking about the things they did to build support for Climate Action Muskoka.
One of the really a key things that that we had, and this really, Linda was pushing this constantly, was the whole collaboration, that we had to be collaborative. So we had to work along with our district government. I should probably explain that we have, it's not a regional government, it's called the district government, but it's like a regional government. And there are six municipalities underneath that, three municipalities and three townships. So we decided rather than going individually to the municipality level, to the lower tier, that we would go for the upper tier government, which has 22 councillors on it and a chair. But what happened was, so right off the bat, we are very lucky to have a climate initiatives organizer who had been hired by the district with an FCM grant, a Federation of Canadian Municipalities grant, to work on developing a corporate climate action plan for the district. And he just had a short-term contract, but the district decided to keep him on as a permanent employee. And he is a wonderful young man. So we met with him and his boss, and they are extremely supportive and understand completely why the community has to be acting hand in hand with the government level to move the whole thing forward. So Linda, do you want to take over from there?
Well, I'd just like to interject that and part of this process, when we formed Climate Action Muskoka as a grassroots organization that really wanted to take action, take it locally, and have kind of a two-pronged approach where we would work to initiate climate action through the community, but we would also work to implement it through local government. So the local government portion of this is what Sue is talking about. So that initiative was intended to go to district and get them to not just declare a climate emergency in name only, but to make sure that it was backed with achievable targets, with important targets, let's say, like really solid, and to have that community working group as a part of it, and to have a plan that went along with it so that it had some real meat to it right off the get-go. So when we met with the staff, the environmental, climate change coordinator, the intent was to talk to them about what was the most achievable way for us to get this passed at the district level. They wanted this kind of push from the community. They wanted to see it come from the community at the staff level. And we had to talk about the, you know, how we could work the political process so we could bring counselors on board so that when it actually eventually came before them, they were ready to buy it totally.
The other key point here was that it is science-based. That was a really important for us, and it was really important for some of our endorsers in the community. So we decided then, after we wrote the resolution with all kinds of input from various segments of the community, Labor took a look at it, Kevin, our district staff people, actually gave us a lot of the phrasing in there, because we're not legal experts in any way. We really had no idea what we were doing or where we were going. So we looked at resolutions from all over the world and used pieces of those, and until we were happy with what we had. And then we went to the community for endorsements, for individual endorsements. Fortunately, we have an IT person who had already set up a website, and as one of the founders, she said, why don't you guys just take over the website? So we said, hey, that's, and the name came from her as well. So that's Tamsin Tilson. So we got business endorsements, community groups, and eventually, after much work and Linda's wonderful communication skills in writing, we got the Muskoka Watershed Council to endorse unanimously the resolution. And just to give you just a little backstory on that, when I first went to the district chair and said, you know, we wanted to climate an emergency passed, he just looked at me and he said, I only listen to the Muskoka Watershed Council. Okay, so we knew then who we had to get in order to really move this forward. It was moving forward, and once it was moving forward, then the Watershed Council came in right at the last minute, actually after we had presented to council, and said, we fully endorse this because it's based on science and we have to do this. So we were just feeling our way along, Maya, truly. Hey, Linda, we'd never really lobbied before to get, we also had contact, personal contact with all of the counselors, phone calls, we shared information with them. We tried to do some education, and Kevin was out there working away on his corporate plan. And the counselors, because it's such a big job, they only listen to staff, it feels like. And still not sure they understand the importance of the community piece.
Although I do think that the staff gets the importance of, yes, certainly the Kevin, the climate coordinator, he gets the importance of community. I think when you look at the process that Sue's talking about, that we developed the resolution. We made sure it was strong. We also backed it up with some things that district and municipal levels of government could take on, some things that they could take on right away and some things that would be down the road. But we gave some, we had a support document that was not part of the plan, but a support document to give them a vision, a picture of what that needed to look like. But in the process, so the first developed the resolution, got community endorsement. Then we had to work at, as Sue said, building those relationships with all of the counselors, and we workshopped it with Muskoka Watershed Council. They are an independent, science-based organization that is highly regarded in the community. They advise the district government, but they are independent. They are not voted in. They have a commitment to the science and the protection of the Muskoka watershed as a whole, because it is the economic driver of the economy as in Muskoka as well. It's a tourist-based region. So workshopping it with them was the next step. And then talking to counselors, we really had to build the credibility of our voice and the build the buy-in from those who were going to be voting on it. And then the next step after that, we met with them in January. We wanted them to get this to district council in February. We wanted it passed. However, we realized that it wasn't going to be quite that quick, and then COVID struck, so we were really put on the back burner. But in the interim, we were advised that we would be best to take it to the committee level first, so that if they accepted it, then the district would pass it. So that was the next step. So that's the process, sort of thing.
Well, I was just going to add that in the process of lobbying and these counselors, we actually identified our counselor allies on all of the lower tier councils, because there are three or four of the lower tier councilors actually on the district. So we now have a really good start for our next plan is to go take the climate emergency resolutions to the individual municipalities, but different people in those municipalities will take them forward, but with a united voice. So we're just at that point now where we have to meet and figure out, well, what resolution are we taking there, and what will be our presentation be, what, you know, that kind of thing. But that whole identification of allies was really, really important. And I feel like I can phone certainly my local and say, hey, you know, and they'll take my call, and we'll have a good long conversation about whatever. They seem to be really open to that now, and they're very friendly. I'm just surprised to find out how friendly. They're just people like us, and
once they see that one can organize, they're so impressed, right? Now, so let's start by going a little bit back. Tell me a little bit about yourselves and your committee and how you started. Like, what was it? When did you start organizing? Like, you said that you first went to the council in December. So you must have started organizing way before December 2019.
We didn't go to council in December. It was passed this last December. We actually got the whole thing passed. But no, it started out quite innocently. I was with another organization, Muskoka Power of Many, and their whole point is to try to support actions that are going on in our community in whatever area, as long as they're progressive actions. And so we had done some actions around the Ontario provincial government and around legal aid and so forth. And around, we did a banner drops on the highway about the Ford government to get the message across to tourists. This was 15 months ago, right? And so then that September was the big international Fridays for Future strike. And I went to them and I said, hey, can we organize, you know, a climate event? And they said, sure, go for it. So I took that on. We had 300 people show up in our little town of Huntsville, which is one of our three towns. And what is their population there? About, I don't know, 10 or 12,000. We had 300 people show up. We had Gordon Laxer, who is a national, he's a member of our group, and he has, he's an energy expert, writes for Canadian Council of Canadians. He spoke. The person who's now the head of the OFL, the Ontario Federation of Labour, spoke. I spoke for the first time ever in my life with a little rabble-rousing speech, which I heard later was considered passionate. We had high school students speak, and we had a 10-year-old boy speak. And then we did our little thing, and then we had our little march. And people kept coming up to me. And then it was the election, right? The Ontario election. And Linda was working.
Federal election. You were gone.
The federal election. Linda was working on that, and then, but we hadn't really connected on any of this stuff. And I, at that September thing, I called for a climate emergency to be declared by the district and all of the municipalities, right? Well, was I naive? Figured they'd all go back and do it. Well, they didn't. And, but people kept coming to me throughout that election period and saying, you know, we can't let this energy die. People said it at the 300 people showing up. It's unheard of in a small town. We can't let this energy die. And I just said, well, you know, like, I'm going to wait until after the election, and Linda will be back, and I'll reach out and talk to her. And so that's how it all started. And but we continued the strikes, but in another town, in Bracebridge, and that's where I met Tamsin. So she had all this IT stuff and wanted to do more, and had the name and the website. And I had the idea of calling together all the people who'd spoken to me about, well, we can't let this energy die. And then each of them seems to have brought people. So the 1st of November in 2019, then that's when it was, 2019, in the middle of this horrendous snowstorm, 19 out of 21 people who had been invited to that meeting showed up, and the roads were deadly. It was, I couldn't believe it. And we just met in somebody's house, and we went from there. We decided we just kind of brainstormed. And it's a really loose-knit group. We meet every month. We never know who's going to show up. We've now started to invite the public just to come in and listen. And we're doing some webinars. We've done 2 or 3 webinars now. So that's kind of helping bring more people in. But it's really, the core group's what, about six or seven of us that are really active and keeping the thing going.
And so how do you think that was built? Like, where do you think this urgency came from? Was it already latent and people were just waiting for somebody to say mm-hmm. something? Is it that in why is there this urgency in Muskoka?
Although there are key people doing the majority of the organizing and the outreach and the work, there are so many that are you know, supporting us and, you know, holding our back. As you know, in any organization, there are the ones who really get the work done, and there are those who are just so happy somebody's getting the work done and want to support them. So in all honesty, there is that dimension to this organization. However, different people have taken on different responsibilities. Back to your question, your question was, how did we get that many people to turn out? Well, certainly at that event, we were really helped by the publicity around Greta Thunberg. So there was an appetite for that kind of climate action. But the June before that, I'm a key organizer as well with our provincial Green Party of Ontario. And the June before that, we hosted a community climate action conference also in Huntsville, but we drew from all over. And we had, you know, 15 speakers pretty much. And that was attended by over 200 people. So those people too said, We've got to keep this moving. We have to work on this. I think that I'm not sure whether this is the place, but I think it's important to point out that besides the political action, We did structure Climate Action Muskoka into a number of subcommittees that people were in areas that people really had passion. So food and food security and food waste was one, and a transportation committee to work on some initiatives around, growing an electric vehicle buying group and informing people about, what might be the options and how to build the EV infrastructure. We had another group that was working on the building sector. We have some real expertise in the group around the whole new wave in building that will allow us to use carbon sequestering materials. So we were able to build those pieces into what we saw as a community climate action plan that we were taking to the district as well. But so in the short time that we've been together, especially with leadership from Sue and Lynn, the key things that we've accomplished in this short while of time is to have a really impactful website that's updated all the time. We hosted a series of articles in the local paper over a period of 14 weeks that covered so many climate action that could be taken locally and were very informative and written by people in our community. One of our, Tamsin Tilson, one of the organizers, has hosted a monthly radio show called Muskoka Drawdown, and she's interviewed people in throughout the community on different aspects of, based on sort of the Project Drawdown book, but what can happen in Muskoka. And we've done a number of radio, TV interviews. We've hosted webinars and been invited to present at webinars. And we've had quite a bit of local media coverage. And part of that coverage comes because we are on the street every Friday with our signs. So, and when people say, why are you doing that? Our response is that we know this is keeping this issue really visible in our community. And it has grown to the point where, people drive by and they wave and they honk and they roll their windows down and thank us for keeping this issue so prominent and alive in our community. So along with the political action, the community action over in just this one year and during COVID has really, we can be proud of it. And now we've launched another community initiative to support what the district is doing. And Sue and Lynn can speak to the Community Carbon Challenge.
Those strikes, by the way, were basically nonstop from September 2019 in our communities. And at one point we had all three of the small towns. There were strikes happening there. And then, of course, COVID hit and we have two of them back up and running. But now that we're in lockdown for a month or so, we're just doing online signs and so forth. But it's still a strike and it's been nonstop. Okay, so this year we have two initiatives that were really our main ones. One is getting the climate emergencies declared in our lower municipalities so that we can... It's really hard to go in and start talking about you got to change policy for the building community to require this and that and the other thing, or get them to work on a real plan for active infrastructure if you don't have something in place as a resolution that's saying, well, we're committed to doing this. Then we can go in and say, well, you said you're committed to doing this. Here's a way that we can now deal with your building that will help you to reduce to 50%. So that's one of the things we're doing. And we will be on, can I backtrack just a bit? Lynn, I probably should have mentioned the climate climate initiatives coordinator has developed a corporate climate action plan. And our resolution, I'll also ask for a community-wide carbon action plan, which has not been developed yet, but it's included as part of his corporate plan. And so he will be setting up a community working group, he said in February, March, soon, with invited stakeholders, hopefully a diverse, we've asked for diverse and representative of the whole area. And that group will be tasked with developing the criteria for a community climate action plan. So that's where that piece is at. So that we expect we will be asked to have participation on that committee. Okay, so back to where we're at with this year. So we're going to the councils, and then the other piece we have is we decided we wanted to bring the community in. So we have a 50% by 2030 community carbon challenge, which if you go to climateactionmuskoka.org, it's right there on the website. And we are asking families to sign up every week, every 2 weeks. There's a new item going in there. It's hard for me to explain it. You probably should just go look at it yourself. But all of the actions are easy. We acknowledge that big action has to happen from governments and businesses, but that we also all have to be moving together, and that collective action of many, many households is going to have a huge impact as well. Plus, send a message to our counselors that we need them to act in the support as they're in the community. And then there's this whole idea of that tipping point for have of ideas, and when ideas tip over and are, if a small percentage of people are believing it and doing it, suddenly everyone is. And so we're hoping to reach that, or to help to reach that tipping point. So we see it as two prongs going along: the district government, the community action. The community carbon challenge is exactly the same as the district. We are saying to you, okay, we're asking the district to do this. You know, you can do it too with your family. 77 families have signed up, and that represents about 170 something people and one dog.
And it feels like there's a real momentum happening in Muskoka.
We hope so. Some days we don't believe it.
Well, you know, I think that when, even though we may not always feel it, the community is feeling it. So we really are being recognized now as the go-to organization, and we're being, you know, we're being referred to CAM. It, sometimes in the same sense with the Muskoka Watershed Council. That's impressive.
You've been listening to an interview with Sue McKenzie and Linda Mathers of Climate Action Muskoka in conversation with Rebel.ca's Maya Bular. The citizens group played a key role in getting a climate emergency declaration passed in October 2020. And shortly afterwards, in December 2020, a collaborative multi-level climate strategy called A New Leaf, Muskoka's climate strategy, provided a roadmap and teeth to the declaration. You can also read Maya's article about Climate Action Muskoka by going to rabble.ca. It's called Why Muskoka Declared a Climate Emergency. Coming weeks, we'll have more conversations with Rabble Rousers to watch. We'll also be featuring their stories on the text pages of rabble.ca. They're really interesting people and stories from across the country, so please tune in and please read. The theme music you're listening to is a composition by rabble.ca's parliamentary reporter, Carl Narenberg. It's called La Tuladie en Hiver. Thank you very much for letting us use this for this series, Carl. This is really special. You can hear the whole thing and see Carl playing by going to his YouTube page. I'll post the links in the show notes. Thank you.
judge no more. Go out shopping, can't see the store. I can't believe that we're really all good. One of us has gone where they never
than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask, and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.